Chapter 22. After he left Kit's house, Manny walked the 100 yards or so to the main farm road renewed. There was a rightness to this moment. How surprised Kit had been. How her throat had pulsed. Her pupils gaped wide open. He liked the changes he saw. The funny pageboy hair and the heft in her arms. The toasted color of her skin. She'd been working, hard labor by the looks of it. The smell of it, too. By God's grace, he had refrained from pinning her to the door and taking 14 years of touch in a lump sum. Now, the urge to return to her, to pry her open with questions, to grope her all over, was so acute he felt himself listing forward, as if into a strong gale, to resist it. There would be time for catching up another day. He couldn't rush her. If he was going to stay, he would have to find work. Honest work. No mischief to mar the clean surface of his slate. With all these little ranches, someone was bound to need his help. He felt infinite patience surround him and walked toward town. His town. Their town. Far ahead, he saw the steeple of a small church reaching above the tops of a cluster of live oak. How fitting. He said a prayer of thanks and continued down his path. At the crest of a small hill, a silvery lump shimmered on the hot asphalt. As he got closer, he could see it was fresh roadkill, a possum turned inside out, its face intact and grinning. Tough luck, he thought. He squatted to look at the thing, now a mass of pulp and fur. Boo, he said, and grimaced back at the stinking creature overrun with flies. He dragged the possum by its ratty tail and laid it to rest in the grassy ditch. A paunchy man in his 50s edged the church house path with a weed whacker. He wheezed with exertion and focused so intensely on his task that he didn't see Manny standing in front of him. Manny waited. The man wore a clerical collar on a sleeveless shirt, and when he looked up and saw Manny, he yelled, "Holy shit!" Manny hadn't meant to startle the man, but as a boy, he had loved to hide behind corners and jump out at people as they passed by. Loved seeing the horror on their faces, the panicked breath, the animal twitch. It was a thrill to see the masks of politeness fall away. Nothing was more honest or lovable than terror. These were the times when he felt closest to them. Manny chuckled and removed his hat in easy reverence. The man killed the motor.
Didn't mean to catch you off guard there, Father.
You can call me Pastor Tom. How do?
They shook hands. Pastor Tom seemed friendly, but circumspect.
Raised Catholic, Pastor. Old habits die hard. My name is Manny Romero.
How can I help you, sir?
The pastor asked, wiping grass clippings stuck to the sweat on his arms.
I'm looking to work.
Okay, where are you coming from?
Tom asked. Manny knew most people could sense a lie, and he'd found the more truthful he was, the more people trusted him.
I just served over a decade in state prison and am hoping for a new start.
I see,
Tom said soberly. He rested his folded hands atop his belly.
What were your crimes?
Armed robbery and aggravated assault. Guilty as charged. I'm not proud of what I done, but I served my time and hope to make it up.
Make it up to who, son?
Manny laughed humbly.
I guess I don't know yet. There is a girl, but I don't think she'll have me.
You're to reckon with God before any woman or man. Hard work is a good enough place to start. Can you clean?
I could make a prison toilet sparkle.
Are you a drinking man?
I was prone, yes, but not since prison. I much prefer a warm woman, to be honest.
You are honest, I'll say that.
Pastor Tom buffed his head with a hanky and seemed to consider the request. Cicadas chattered in the lull between the two men. Manny waited patiently.
Well, unless there's something else you want to tell me, I'm happy to have you. I can't pay you enough to live on, so you'll need another job. But my wife can feed you. Lord knows I could spare a second helping, he said and swatted his gut.
Pastor Tom handed Manny the weed whacker.
Welcome.
Thank you, sir. Thank you much.
Manny put his hand on Pastor Tom's shoulder.
Pastor Tom, could we pray?
Surprise, verging on alarm, colored Tom's face. But he nodded and bowed his head. By initiating a prayer, Manny knew he was encroaching on the pastor's role as spiritual leader. He couldn't help toying with the man's ego, but he made a note to back off until their rapport was more secure. If he could win over the pastor, he'd have the good graces of all of Pecan Hollow. That Sunday, Manny went to the church and stood outside the open doors, assessing, as always, the exits and variables within. The thin windows of the church house vibrated with the hymns of a motley choir in shiny purple gowns, passably in tune, invigorated by the Holy Spirit. The pious congregation swayed and clapped, singing by heart a song of Jesus's boundless love. A little girl in big glasses cried into her elbow, confused and overwhelmed by charismatic fervor. Pastor Tom presided with pinched brow, keeping time by patting the side of his thigh as he paced in front of the narrow pulpit. Manny buffed the dust off his boots on the backs of his calves and walked through the doors. The eyes of the congregation swept across him, and heads turned to consult with their seatmates. He wondered what they must think, these plain country folks, of his striking features, his kingly carriage. He had always savored the way his looks ruffled people like a kind of magic. He tried to connect with Pastor Tom, but the pastor was at the pulpit collecting his thoughts. Manny tucked himself into a pew in the middle of the sanctuary. An elderly couple in front of him craned their heads around and stared, yellow-eyed and unfriendly. When a woman with a starchy-looking beehive saw him sit next to her, she cast an ugly little glare, crimped her purse, and slid her giant rump down the pew. It occurred to Manny that the woman was giving him birth not out of deference, but out of fear. He scanned the room, hoping this response was an anomaly, but could see from the slant eyes and pursed mouths that they were all, to a man, suspicious of him. Manny was as shaken by his inability to read the situation as he was by the rejection itself. And in this holy place, he felt compelled to revise their wrong impression of him, but was too unnerved. He had had so little experience with rejection, he found it nearly impossible to bear. He opened the hymnal, hot at the neck, not seeing the printed word. In the middle of the first reading, the double doors opened, letting in a harsh light, and Sandy scurried in with a woman who appeared to be her mother. She looked embarrassed, and her mother trembled. The older woman seemed freshly high. They took seats in the last row of pews near the aisle. Sandy had pulled her stringy hair back tight, showing pink rows of scalp. She wore what appeared to be a secondhand dress, her nicest one, no doubt, which was better suited for a bar than for a church. Her mother had a Sunday hat high on the crown of her head and slightly askew. She stuck her bedroom slippered feet into the aisle and slumped into a morbid, asthmatic sleep. Manny ducked out of his pew and went to sit between them, relieved to see a kindly face.
"What are you doing here?" Sandy whispered, delighted.
"I never miss a Sunday service," he said.
She blushed and tucked down her chin.
"You sure look nice," she said.
Manny looked over the spandex dress and glitter rubbed across her breasts.
"Thanks," he said.
When her face sagged a little, he added, as a token,
"You too."
The song ended and Pastor Tom raised his hands aloft and people hushed as they waited for the sermon. A teenager stood and ushered a squirmy flock of children to Bible school in the adjacent building. Sandy nestled against Manny and he slipped his hand down the back of her dress. She raised her lips to his ear and whispered humidly,
"You're bad, Mr. Manny."
Sandy's mother had been snoring arrhythmically since they first sat down, but now she stopped and rolled forward on herself, kind of slithering into the aisle. Sandy called out for her mother and lunged across Manny's lap.
"Sit down," he said. "I'll take care of this."
He swiped a short pencil from the pew in front of him and knelt at her mother's side. He sensed the eyes upon him again. He heard one woman shriek,
"What's he done to her?"
And another shot back,
"Oh, you know what's bothering her as much as I do."
Pastor Tom called for order. Manny felt the woman's pulse, which was very slow but steady, and her breath barely perceptible. He'd roused enough people out of dope-induced stupors to know she'd be fine. But it occurred to him to use this unfortunate scene to his advantage. He waved away a few people who had gathered around.
"Please, stay back," he said. "This woman's heart has stopped. Someone call an ambulance. I'm gonna try to bring her back."
He straddled her, stacked his hands at the base of her sternum, and pressed 5 times, but not so hard as to wake her. He repositioned, pinched her nose, and breathed into her mouth. He felt her lips move inside his and hoped she didn't wake too soon. The longer she stayed passed out, the better the effect would be when he revived her. He could hear the murmur rise and fall across the crowd. Prayers and speculations, even tears. Sandy chewed on the end of her braid, whimpering as tears ran down her cheeks. He continued the CPR for 3 cycles, then 4, until finally he heard the woman making sounds and knew it was time. He jabbed the blunt end of the pencil into her ribs, and she shot up as if from a nightmare and howled. The congregants were silent for a moment. Ms. Blanchette panted and swayed. He held her hand gallantly and helped her lie back down. Then Sandy collapsed next to her mother.
"Oh, Mama,"
she said, weeping, then jumped up and threw her arms around Manny. Pastor Tom shouted,
"Praise God!"
And there erupted a vibrant chorus of "Hallelujah" and "Sweet Jesus."
"Come up here, son, and let us take a look at you," Pastor Tom said with his arms spread wide.
Manny knew not to take center stage.
"Sir," he said, "might I stay by her side till the medics get here? It just doesn't feel right to leave her alone."
Pastor Tom stepped off the dais and strode toward him, embraced him with a great slap on the back.
"Bless you, son," he said. "Only God is responsible, and only He deserves your thanks," Manny said loudly enough for the others to hear.
Heroism had caught their attention, and humility would secure their loyalty. Country people ate that shit up with a spoon.
"I hate to have disrupted the service. Now let's all get back to worshiping the Lord."
"Everyone,"
This is Manuel Romero. He's new in town. I hope you'll make him feel real welcome.
To Manny's deep satisfaction, they all began to clap. They filed past him, shaking his hand. Women who had looked upon him as if he were a virulent leper now noticed the blue of his eyes and shyly offered their hands in greeting. Manny thanked God for sending Sandy's mama to his aid. Chapter 23. Kit set out to walking, unsure where she would go, but compelled to leave the little house until the shimmy in her legs was gone. She could feel the hard, black scab on her shin rubbing against her jeans. It had been 2 weeks since Manny had shown up, and Kit had managed to avoid him, but not the rumors of his heroism at church. Something about it stank of old Manny. How conveniently he made such a splash when he rolled into town. Not knowing why he was there or what he was up to was eating at her like acid. She had an urge to tear across the fields faster than her legs could go. She ended up at Doc's. Doc bumped the door open with her hip, in her hands, a giant lop-eared rabbit.
I need Warbucks for a bit.
You want to get up on that nut?
Doc said, looking like she was holding in a list of follow-up questions. The rabbit kicked its legs and twisted, almost slipping out of Doc's grasp. She snatched it by the loose skin behind its ears.
Baby, if you can catch him, you can ride him, she said. Throw him some food, why don't you, while you're at it?
Kit tried Charlie's alfalfa lure, and Warbucks came right to her, dipped his head low for a scratch and a nuzzle, and took the halter without a fight. He didn't make getting on as easy for her. As she heaved the saddle up over his withers, he skirted away, and she nearly fell over from the forward motion of 40 pounds of leather. Once the saddle was on, he blew out his gut to keep her from cinching the girth too tight. She had to canter him on a lead rope and cinch it twice before it fit snug enough that she wouldn't slide right underneath him. She was too short, her hamstrings too tight, to get on him using the stirrup. So she held the reins and saddle horn in one hand and pulled as she swung her right leg up and over. Her seat was still lopsided when he began to buck, more a flirtation than an earnest pitch. She knew that if he had wanted her off, she'd be pasture-bound and breathless in one two-legged kick. They clopped the asphalt road through town and past the diner. A few people lit up in the window, no doubt swapping stories about nothing in particular. The smell of fryer grease lingered long after they left the paved road for softer footing. This path ran past the bigger ranches, the Haggertys, the Fultons, and the Kingstons, wealthy folks, oilmen and cattle barons, too big to dwell full-time in Pecan Hollow. Having ridden without incident for some time, she felt emboldened to go faster and urged Warbucks with a squeeze of her thighs. As if he had been waiting for his cue all evening, he reared a little and surged ahead in an instant gallop. The rush of air cooled the damp on her face and neck and under her arms. The speed and the danger of losing her seat frightened her, lashed her attention to the task of staying balanced and hanging on. A fistful of coarse mane in one hand, the horn in the other, she recovered the flailing stirrups with her toes, sank her weight back into her heels, and found herself more secure. As she settled, she sensed the horse unwinding and drumming a steady rhythm. Up ahead, she saw the chapel. The marquee read, "Bible study, 5 p.m., led by Manuel."
"You gotta be kidding me," she muttered. "It couldn't be."
She pulled back on the reins and strained to peer inside, but she couldn't get close enough on Warbucks without giving herself away. She parked him by the hitching post, a carved statue of Jesus holding out a brass ring. As she approached the multipurpose room, its doors open for a cross breeze, she heard Manny reading a passage.
At that point, Peter got up the nerve to ask, "Master, how many times do I forgive a brother or sister who hurts me? 7? Jesus replied, 7? Hardly. Try 70 times 7.
So it was him, Manny, reading stories to the Bible thumpers of Pecan Hollow? Never in her life would she have guessed it. It was unnerving, this change of character, and the quickness to settle in her town. Flagrant, even. An affront. But soon, the rounded murmur of his voice, both familiar and, in this context, foreign and out of place, began to have a sedative effect. For a moment, she felt childlike and open. Then she heard a rising chatter and scooting of chairs, signaling the end of the meeting. She rose quietly, crossed over to Warbucks, and started untying his tether.
"When did you get here?"
Manny said, suddenly at her side. She backed up and tripped over the gutter that ran from the side of the building. He reached out to steady her.
"Whoa there, kitty cat."
He held out his hands to show he meant no harm. She pushed him off. The shame of being discovered scorched her face. He smiled in a doting, parental way, as if Kit could do no wrong. She had melted under that look as a kid, but today it felt condescending. She took 2 long steps away from him.
"Hey, what are you doing lurking around back here?"
he said.
"You could have come in, you know."
There was a small Bible, feathered with paper notes, sticking out of his pocket. "I was out for a ride. I didn't know you'd be here." She found it difficult to meet his eyes.
"Since when do you read the Bible?"
"Since prison," he said with a little shrug. "First, I read it because I was bored. Then I came to hate it, because it showed me a side of myself I didn't want to see. Now, of course, I treasure it, because I see now that God accepts me just as I am."
She chafed at his bald piousness, not just the fact of it, but the feeling that she didn't know him anymore.
"So you're just clean now or something? No more cons, no more crime?"
She got madder as she spoke.
"What do you do for money if you're not stealing it out of someone's pocket?"
He smiled and passed over the dig.
"Who's this handsome fella?"
He approached the horse, knuckles up. Warbucks pushed back and shied away. But Manny gripped him by the bridle and stroked the bow of his neck.
"Leave him," she said.
"Easy, easy there," he said.
Warbucks yielded, but did not relax.
"Listen, I don't get what you're up to, why you're here," Kit said, "but I don't need you making trouble in my life."
"I'm making trouble," he said. "You're the one out here spying on me."
He could always turn it back on her. Kit wanted to evaporate. She punched the side of the church and yelled. Warbucks nickered and snatched a spray of weeds by the gutter.
"Don't mess this up for me," she said, ignoring his taunt. "I like my life. I've been just fine here without you."
She leaned against the wall and took a breath.
"What do you want from me?"
Manny looked down at his boots and kicked up a divot in the grass.
"Look, the last thing I want is to cause you trouble. I spent the last decade praying for you, wishing you good things, feeling sorry for what I did to you."
"Sorry? Ha!"
She heard the waver in her voice.
"Since when are you sorry for anything?"
She wanted to hate him and fear him.
Kit, I'm here because I want to earn your forgiveness.
Forgiveness. Something in her crumbled at this word.
Oh, yeah? She said. What for?
Let me count the ways, he said. For starters, I blew it that last day. Shouldn't have been drinking and going off script. Stupid.
What was all that about, anyway?
He moved slightly toward her.
Kitty cat, you really want to hash this out here? Let's go somewhere and talk.
She shook her head and stepped back. There was too much to atone for. She couldn't shake the image of those two cooks knocked out on the floor, or the look of terror on Mrs. Stoker's. He didn't deserve to be here, or to see Charlie, whom he hadn't even wanted. She should chew him out, or fight him, but all she could think to do was run. She tugged the loose end of the lead rope and in one swift movement had hoisted herself onto Warbuck's back and was tearing off. Chapter 24. It was mosquito hour when the insects emerged in a low-lying fog against the green haze of dusk. The smell of warm moss and manure hung in the humid air. Charlie hurried up the steps and smacked a blood-swollen mosquito at the back of her neck. She felt like she was starving. Since she hit puberty, oh, how she despised the word, she had fits of hunger that came on like a riot. Charlie opened the refrigerator door and let it clunk against the cabinets, something Kit hated, in pointless protest. Even though they had, in their way, made up after the scuffle in the front yard, Charlie was still sore. That man was the first ever person from Kit's past, the first proof that her mother hadn't just materialized as an adult the same time Charlie was born. She was so thirsty for a story, to know about her mom, that she was tempted to hunt down the man and ask him herself. She supposed Kit loved her, the way a mom has to love a child by definition. But she had a feeling that Kit, like a racehorse prancing in its stall, would bolt if anything released her from that duty. The fridge was typically sparse. A glass bottle of buttermilk, a filmy packet of bologna, a jar of pickled okra. She emptied the bottle in one long swig, then wrenched open the jar, fished out a spear of okra, and wrapped it in bologna to tide her over while she decided what to do for dinner. She looked for change in the coffee can under the sink and found just enough to eat out. The stench of bug spray, the hard stuff, hung around her as she approached the diner. After she entered, she stood in the blast of air conditioning for a moment before straddling a swivel chair at the counter and double-checking the coins in her pocket. $3.16. Her old babysitter, Sandy, came by to take her order.
Oh, hey, Charlie, how you?
She said, looking glad to have company.
Pretty good, pretty hungry.
Sandy shimmied the skirt of her uniform down from where it had ridden up at the widest part of her hips and flipped to a fresh page on her notepad.
All right, what you having? Can I have a peanut butter malt and a side of buttered toast for $3?
Sure,
Sandy said with a snap of her gum.
What do you say? Please.
Charlie played along with Sandy's little game. She was a nice person, Sandy. There was a time when she had felt like a big sister. But ever since Charlie had been 9 or 10, she'd known she was smarter than Sandy, which made her feel sorry for the waitress. Sandy was the kind of person that got pushed around by life and everyone in it. Realizing this about Sandy, Charlie had resolved to always be in charge of herself and never take shit from anyone. Sandy returned with a stack of buttered toast and a frosty stainless steel cup. She set the toast in front of Charlie and poured the peanut butter malt into a tall, fluted glass. There was a little malt left in the steel cup, which she held out for Charlie.
You can have it, Charlie said.
Aw, ain't you sweet?
Sandy said and downed the melted malt, tapping the side to get the last of the slush. She thumbed the malt from the corners of her mouth.
Wanna know a secret?
She looked around with twinkling eyes. Without waiting for a response, she said,
I'm in love.
Charlie cringed at her openness. She imagined the sorts of guys who could win Sandy's easy heart. A toothless crackhead, maybe. Or a horny married man. Or, more likely, some barely decent-looking trucker passing through town who would only use her and leave her on his way out. Sandy had left a sizable and diverse population of exes in and around Pecan Hollow. Old and young, dozens of truckers, farmers, hired hands. Once she slept with her second cousin on accident and a pair of brothers, not hers, on purpose. Last year, she had gone after Bill Marcus after his wife died, and when he broke it off, she went after his 15-year-old son. Sadly, Sandy's type was anyone who would pay her attention. Charlie scolded herself for thinking so ill of Sandy, but she knew she was right. She cut her toast into strips and dipped them in the malt.
Dang, that's a good malt, she said.
Sandy smiled.
I know. I put just a pinch of salt in it. Makes all the difference.
She filled the metal cup, left it in the sink, and came back over to Charlie.
What's he like, or whatever?
Charlie asked, her best attempt at interest. Sandy's fair lashes fluttered, eyes bright.
I'm not even kidding. He's the hottest guy you have ever seen. He's real exotic and smart as a whip. Like, he never stops thinking. You can just tell.
Sandy drifted for a bit and then reengaged like she'd just remembered something.
Plus, he's a man of God.
Oh, Christ,
Charlie said too quietly for Sandy to hear. It really pissed her off how shitty Sandy's life was. She could give her a lecture about spending less time on boys and more time reading books or learning a skill or something. But maybe the kinder thing was to allow the girl her fantasies.
You know,
Charlie said, wiping her mouth with a paper napkin,
if there were a competition for best malt, you would win first place.
Sandy blushed at the compliment.
Everyone's good at something,
she said softly, and turned and left Charlie to her meal. Charlie honed in on her supper. She savored every buttery mouthful of her humble supper, sipped her malt slowly. She had a vague impression that someone had sat next to her but was so engrossed in eating that when the man pressed his hand against her mid-back, she nearly fell off her seat with surprise. Charlie grabbed the counter to keep from falling. Someone reached out a hand to help her. It was Dirk, the boy she had seen outside Doc's stable. Charlie refused the hand and struggled to right herself.
Sorry to startle you, he said.
Charlie scowled, but Dirk just smiled wider.
Okay if I sit next to you.
She saw Sandy move away as if to give them room, but could feel her watching.
Free country, Charlie said,
hoping she didn't look as embarrassed as she felt, like a cat who had sprung up and failed to land on its feet.
What are you doing here?
He asked.
This is pretty much the only place to eat, and I wanted some supper, so I came here, Lord, she huffed.
He shook his head in disbelief.
What's it like to get so worked up over nothing all the time, Missy?
The question only made her feel more worked up. It was strange how he was neither bothered nor intimidated by her attitude.
She didn't know what to do but pick a fight.
"Why are you so curious about me, wanting to know every little thing?" she asked. "Do you like me or something?"
She made it sound like an accusation, but once she asked, she realized she wanted to know the answer. Dirk let the question hang and stirred his coffee. After a minute, he said,
"I don't think I know you well enough to like you."
Charlie felt her stomach drop and tried not to let it show. Dirk went on,
"But what little I see makes me want to know more."
She let her long hair fall like a curtain between them so she could blush and smile in private. It was as if her feelings were attached to him by a leash that he could pull in any direction he wanted. She suddenly became aware of herself. Had she bathed today? What did she smell like? She knew she hadn't combed her hair. Looking at her lap, she saw a smear of peanut butter malt in the fringe of her jean cutoffs. How could she be such a slob? She unfolded a pointlessly thin paper napkin and tried to cover the spot. This was new to her. She had noticed boys before, but vaguely and superficially. Tim Pritchard for his blue-green eyes, the Brunel twins for being not bad-looking, and twins. Gil, what's his name, for his shoulder-length hair he kept tucked behind his ears. And even so, the interest was passing and low voltage. With Dirk, she felt like a Tesla coil. She liked his looks, but there was something about the way he was, guileless, totally open and curious, that confused and excited her. They sat in silence for a few minutes while Charlie got over herself and Dirk glanced at the menu.
"I don't know why I bother to look at this thing," he said,
and slapped the menu shut.
"I always order biscuits and gravy."
Charlie still didn't know what to say. Why was she all locked up? Dirk leaned in.
"Say, why do you think Sandy's taking so long to come over here and take my order?"
Charlie looked and saw Sandy idly drying a coffee cup, her ear cocked toward the two. Her open demeanor seemed to have soured. He leaned in closer to Charlie's ear, sending a rolling charge down her spine.
"Looks to me like she's eavesdropping."
As if on cue, Sandy came over, still drying the very dry cup, and asked Dirk curtly for his order.
"Biscuits and gravy, and don't be shy with the gravy."
"Ain't you trying to lose weight, Durkin?"
Sandy said, one brow arched. Dirk smiled a big fake smile back at her.
"Drown 'em to hell."
Sandy warmed up his coffee and returned to her station, checking them out through the side of her eyes. Dirk set Charlie's bike in the bed of his silver Toyota truck.
"You don't see many foreign cars around here," Charlie said.
Dirk laughed.
"Yeah, I get a lot of shit for this one. You'd think I was a communist or something just because I drive Japanese."
He cleared the baggies and beer bottles off the seat. A horse blanket covered coiled springs that had popped through the upholstery underneath. She sat down and took in the weedy, dust, and diesel smell. She put her feet up on the dash.
"Where to, miss?"
She was glad he asked, because she wasn't ready to go home yet. She shrugged.
"I have an idea," he said.
She was content to let him lead and lay her head against the seat back, belly full of milkshake and butterflies. They pulled through a rusting gate and approached a clearing. At the far reach of the headlights was Mockingbird Lake. She tensed. Had she seen this in a horror film? Maybe she shouldn't have gone with him so easily. She glanced around, noting a hunting knife in the caddy by the dash. When he parked at the bank, he got out and left her in the car. She watched him rummage for something in the back of the truck, and she took the knife, slipping it down her boot just in case. Just like her mom had taught her. Dirk left the headlights on, and the moths and night bugs all descended on the area. The catfish could be heard bubbling and grunting over Charlie Pride on the radio. He pulled a tube of catfish bait and squeezed the okra paste out into a capsule the size of a grub. It stank of rot and shit and something else. Liver, maybe. After rinsing his fingers in the shallows, he set two bent-up lawn chairs on the shore and gestured for her to sit.
"You first," she said.
Dirk chuckled a little under his breath and gave her a sarcastic salute. He sat and cast his line and held it out to Charlie.
"Here, hold this a sec," he said.
She sat down next to him and took the rod. He shoved his hand in his pocket and pulled out a lighter and a joint.
"What the hell is that?"
Charlie asked, though she knew exactly what it was. The joint between his lips, Dirk mumbled,
"It's a marijuana cigarette."
"What do you want that for?"
She told herself to shut up and be cool, but she had never been this close to drugs before.
"Welp," he said, "I guess it feels good. So does a hot shower. So does a hamburger. So does sex. Just like those things, it's a nice thing to share with someone. Why? Is it weirding you out?"
"I don't know. Maybe you're just trying to take advantage of me."
She wasn't sure she believed that, but she felt the need to push back. Dirk smiled. He held the flame to the twisted end, took a smooth mouthful, and inhaled, holding it a beat before letting it go.
"Whatever, dude," he said.
Charlie reached out to take the joint, but Dirk pulled it back slightly.
"Hey, seriously, no pressure. It's not such a big fucking deal. Just another way to relax."
Charlie took the joint from him and tugged a snort of smoke straight into her lungs. She hacked violently. Dirk laughed and collapsed forward, not even trying to hold himself up. The feeling came on almost instantly, like she was being dipped into warm sand, her head airy, a natural grin forming on her face. She swayed, or thought she was swaying, as if to a ballad, and finally found her center.
"Oh, this is what he meant," she thought. "It just feels good."
"Sure does," Dirk said,
and Charlie realized she had spoken out loud. She handed over the joint, and Dirk toked, thin-lipped.
"So what's your story?"
he asked through billows of smoke.
"My story?
I mean, what's the deal? It's just you and your mom, right?"
She must have signaled her discomfort with the question, because he quickly followed up.
"Sorry, I get a little nosy when I'm high. No shame, honest. My dad took off when I was 6 or something. I didn't mean to make it weird. I was just thinking. People around here talk, you know, how the Walker ladies are a bit of a mystery."
She would not normally indulge such personal questions, but something about the way he asked and the magic running through her body caused the thick wall between her thoughts and her mouth to crumble.
"I don't know," she said between residual coughs. "My mom is pretty stingy on details. I think all her family is gone, but she doesn't like to talk about them. I get this feeling like something terrible happened. Maybe I'm afraid to ask. And whoever my dad was just some guy she went out with when she was younger. She said he was handsome, smart, not much else. Except when I was little. She would say he was the most generous man she had ever met because he let her have me all to herself."
Dirk humped.
"That's sweet. My mom calls my dad a motherfucker."
Charlie's explosive laugh blew snot out her nose. Too high to be embarrassed, she wiped her nose with the tail of her shirt. She was not the only kid in town who didn't know her father. but she might have been the only one who never had a man at home at all. She was glad, at least. She did not have to deal with stepdads and temporary uncles like some of the girls she knew. As she sat there close enough to Dirk to feel him breathe, she admitted to herself she wanted him. Charlie changed the subject.
God, Sandy was being a freak tonight.
Yeah, she was probably just jealous. We hooked up a while back.
You did?
Charlie felt weird, but laughed to show she didn't care.
I mean, if we're being honest, who hasn't hooked up with her?
She snarfed and covered her face with her hands, letting the fishing pole fall to the ground. She picked it up again and jerked on the line.
Poor Sandy.
I shouldn't poke fun because it's really sad. Her mom's a junkie. Her dad never came around. She's just this bottomless pit and she fills it with...
He paused as if searching for the right word.
With dicks.
They both laughed like high people, helplessly.
You're horrible. Now I know how you talk about women. We'll never be an item,
she said, a flirty smile on her lips.
Who said anything about being an item?
He said, grinning right back at her. Charlie found herself studying the broad yoke of his shoulders built for bearing heavy loads, the haze of blonde stubble across his cheeks and chin, his hands nearly twice the breadth of hers. She wanted to prod and squeeze him to know his density and the feel of his skin. She had to stop herself from handling the firm, fatty layer around his middle. A force drew her toward him, not just curiosity or attraction, something more like appetite. She settled into her seat, jerking the line from time to time, not caring that the fish weren't biting. Chapter 25. Kit approached the house only half settled and unsure how she would talk to Charlie. It was past dinner time, and her daughter might be worried, or, more likely, pissed. The kitchen light was on. There was a mess of bologna and an open jar of okra on the counter. She noted the stillness in the house at once and hollered up the stairs. No response. She checked Charlie's room, but it was empty. Downstairs, she found a note on the kitchen counter.
Out. C-H.
Spell out your goddamn name, girl, Kit said, crumpling the paper in her hand.
Even the handwriting, hard strokes of sloppy print, had a bad attitude. Kit wondered where Charlie would have gone. She didn't have any friends, really. Charlie was too headstrong, wouldn't share, and took her feelings out on others. She could make friends sometimes, but she could not keep them. Kit thought about the people she'd seen Charlie with lately, and then remembered the look on that Jim Durkin's face when Charlie was flirting with him at Doc's. An uneasy chill crept over her. He was far too old, 17, 18 maybe, and he had a past. She had played dumb with Charlie, but had known exactly who he was. 2 years ago, Dirk had been dropping acid with some friends behind the truck stop, and one of them had freaked out and run for a quarter mile down the interstate until she got run over by a dozy trucker. She had lived, but barely, and had a feeding tube, and her family had to move to Houston to be near the hospital. Since he had given her the drugs, her parents blamed him. Kit had about 5 different reasons to kick some ass tonight, but she only needed one. The Orchard Trailer Community housed 50-odd trailers on 25 acres of mushy clay. Kit nearly sank her back wheels in a patch of deep mud and just barely finessed her way out. She left her truck at the chain fence entrance and let herself in. A man in a fake lizard cowboy hat stopped her.
"What are you doing here, miss?" he said.
Kit considered whether to blow him off or make nice. Though it pained her, she figured things would go more quickly if she tried the latter. "I'm here to fetch my daughter, Charlotte. I think she's over at Mrs. Durkin's place." The man seemed bothered, but pointed to the other end of the park.
"Corner trailer, back row."
Kit nodded in thanks and moved quickly. She barged into the double wide, using far too much force to pull open the flimsy screen door, causing it to smack the outside of the trailer. Dirk's mother was frying sausage patties at the kitchenette stove, a cigarette between her teeth and spiky curlers in her hair.
"Where's my daughter?" Kit said.
"Get out of my house, you maniac!"
his mother snarled, waving her spatula. Kit blew past her to the closed door in back. She tried the bedroom door, stuck, and kicked it in, the cheap lock easily giving way. Nothing but a twist of dingy sheets, a stack of books, and an anemic mutt who acknowledged the intrusion with a lazy growl. Just then, from behind her, Kit heard the unmistakable chick-chick of a pump-action shotgun.
"Here's another idea," said Mrs. Durkin. "You take your sorry ass out of here, and I won't shoot you in the puss."
With the gun on her, Kit cooled off enough to understand the woman was serious. "God damn it," she grumbled and backed out of the trailer. Mrs. Durkin flicked her ciggy out and locked the door behind her. Kit wove through the trailer homes, sick from waning adrenaline, a numbness starting its crawl from her belly outward. She wanted to hurt someone, but the truth was, she was scared. Scared of losing Charlie, of being left behind, of the sucking cold and blue that followed her around so much of her life. Kit drove her tires hot, 20 miles out, full speed. When she reached the county line, she parked and let her engine idle. Afraid if she crossed it, she'd never come back, she turned around and sped home. She did this over and over until her tank ran low, like a manic dog running laps in a pen. Halfway home, she heard a twangy country song and saw the neon blue sign of the Roll-In Honky Tonk. Kit parked and stepped inside the dim and smoky bar. She edged her way through a moderate crowd, looking through randy bikers and cowboys like they were made of glass. She found a stool and ordered a shot of tequila and a chaser. She took them both down in seconds. With a swirl of her finger, she signaled the bartender for another round. A cowboy slid up next to her.
"Next round is on me," he said, and threw down a 20.
Without looking, she said, "That's okay, I got it."
"I insist," he said,
a courtly hand laid over his heart. Kit glanced up. He was cocky, pretty, and lean. She could tell by the heavy calluses on his palms that the cowboy getup wasn't just for show.
"What the hell?" she thought.
"Bulls?" she asked.
"Bronx," he said. "Name's Trip."
"Kit."
"Pleasure," he said, his green eyes lively.
Bartender pushed two tequilas and two beers in front of them. They clinked and drank.
"How come you look so cranky?"
He dipped his finger in the shot glass and sucked on it.
"Excuse me?"
She was already beginning to regret giving this guy an opening.
"No offense, but you just look like you've got a lot on your mind. Thought you might like to tell someone about it."
"Oh, like you?" she said. The warm feel of her drink was pouring into her lips, cheeks, thighs. Trip shrugged. Kit polished off her beer. She held the brown bottle up to her eyes and saw the bar swirl through the thick glass. She rolled the bottle toward Trip.
You really want to know, huh?
Yes'm.
When I was younger, I got into some trouble with a fella.
What kind of trouble?
He asked.
None of your business, she said.
Though there was a sliver of her that wanted to tell all, broadcast every detail and be done with it. Untold, her crimes were no less shameful, but they were contained. She couldn't just stop now and confess to this guy, some accidental priest, and set in motion the undoing of her constant, diligent silence.
Was he an ex? He asked.
Never really thought of it that way, she said.
Was there a name for what Manny was to her?
I guess you could say that. Anyhow, I thought I'd left him behind, but he's come back.
Well, shit.
Trip rested his chin on his hand, sympathetically. Even though she thought she was finished talking, Kit noticed her mouth kept moving.
On top of that, she said, my 13-year-old daughter is probably fucking some inbreed under a bridge right now.
Trip said nothing and pulled at his beer.
Well, he said after a while, should we go kick his ass?
This was the right thing to say. She felt a surge of beer-driven camaraderie.
Ha! If I knew where he was, I'd say yes.
Her voice belted out louder than she intended. She could feel herself unwinding too fast, like the spool of a kite caught up in a strong wind.
His mama put a shotgun on me and drove me out. He'd be hog food by now if I could find him.
She laughed loosely and realized she hadn't heard the sound in a long time. She thought of Charlie. Poor child, she thought, born to a mama who never laughs. Kit felt swimmy all of a sudden. She flushed pink and began to fan herself. She was overheating and fully drunk.
Fresh air? Trip offered.
God, yes. Kit scooted off the stool and went outside fast as she could get there. A drowsy country song plucked away in the background as Kit cooled off and Trip lit a smoke. He pulled her by the arm and began to dance real slow. She laughed and complied stiffly before falling in step with him. A mama who doesn't dance. He nuzzled her neck and tugged her close. He kissed her. Maybe it was the alcohol, but his touch did not burn. She felt sexy in a drunk, loose-limbed way and kissed back. This closeness felt so sweet, she wondered why she couldn't have it all the time. There had been only three since Manny, all one-night stands, all drunk and anonymous and far from home. She would not want the blowback of sleeping with someone from Pecan Hollow, someone she would have to see again, talk to, someone who might ask questions she didn't want to answer. They swayed together, kissing more hungrily. Then Trip clutched her ass with both hands and lifted her up. She wrapped her legs around his waist. He walked her to the back of his truck and set her down on the open gate. Kit pulled away. She didn't want to just screw in a dark parking lot.
Oh, I don't think so, she said.
No, he said, nibbling her collarbone. I have to go, she said, less forcefully. She did want him, just not here.
Aw, stay a little while.
He cooed and kissed her more gently. Kit surrendered to the warm feeling of being with him. She kissed his neck and squeezed him with her thighs. As she did, she sensed something change in Trip. His movements stopped responding to hers and started to follow their own rough rhythm. He dragged his teeth on her bottom lip and bit down. She tasted blood.
Hi, watch it! It's just a little love bite, he mumbled.
He groped her hungrily, and Kit stiffened, pushing back.
Trip ripped her snap-button shirt wide open and grabbed her breast like a cut of meat. Kit began to thrash.
"Relax, baby."
He sounded like he was breaking a yearling.
"No, no, stop it."
She scanned what little she could see from the bed of the truck and saw no one. Heard nothing but the music, now blaring some shit-kicking AC/DC song that drowned out her voice. Trip tugged his jeans down in front and pushed her farther back in the bed of the truck. He pinned one of her wrists down with one knee and the other with his hand. With his free hand, he yanked at her jeans. She tried to knee him, but his cowboy thighs, forged by clinging to bucking horses, were too strong to pry open. She screamed again, this time not for help. It was that old feeling of being held down, forced to fight when she wanted to be loved. Something surged through her bones and reared up, stronger, and she knew. She could win this fight. She spotted a crowbar by the spare tire. She pulled a deep breath between screams, and the numb feeling took over. She waited for her moment. Soon, he let one hand free to pull her jeans past her knees. She reached for the crowbar, but it was too far. She pulled his head toward her and crunched down on the cartilage of his nose. Trip howled and drew his arm back to punch her, but she kneed him in the groin. He curled and fell over. Kit pulled up her jeans, knelt over him, and slugged him in the face. Blood gushed out his nose and into his ears. She pounded him again and then kicked him in the ribs. She grabbed the crowbar in case there was any fight left in him and hovered over the unmoving body. Then, from behind, someone circled her waist and wrenched the weapon from her. She flailed, confused, and weakened from the beating. Far off, she heard a familiar voice but could not understand the words. The man put her down and turned her, and she saw that it was Caleb, his face lit blue by the neon light of the roll-in sign. Her legs gave out, so she sat down, and he sat next to her.
"Hi, hi there. Come on now."
He put an arm around her shoulder tentatively, and when she did not shrug it off, she pulled her gently to him. She inched toward him in notches until, amid the stench of the dumpster and the greased-up asphalt, his own smell of milk soap drew her near, and to her great surprise, she began to weep. Caleb swaddled her in his arms. Kit's cries slowed down and she began to breathe. It was a strange sensation to be held like this, and she felt suddenly young and small. There was a great throbbing inside, and if she didn't know better, she might say that her wounds were beginning to hurt. As soon as she had the thought, the throbbing went away. She touched her lip where Trip had bitten her and looked at the blood.
"Kit, did he?"
He looked up at the charcoal sky.
"Did he get to you?"
She took a minute to understand his questions.
No.
She said, when she realized he was asking if the cowboy had raped her. Seeing her pants undone, she fastened them.
"No, I don't think so."
He looked over at the battered man, who was beginning to groan.
"Well, you sure got to him,"
he said.
"He's probably been trampled by 2-ton bulls that didn't mark him up like that."
Caleb gingerly moved her off him and went to the battered cowboy. Kit shuddered at the loss of warmth and wished he wouldn't go. He checked the man's pulse at the jugular, slipped a money clip from the man's front pocket, and angled his ID toward the neon light.
"Trip Kendrick. Figures. This fool makes trouble every time he rides into town."
He radioed an EMT from the police car with a casual authority not typical of Caleb, which tickled something in Kit, some primitive need to know that she was in able hands.
"Hey, okay?"
she asked.
Oh, sure, Caleb said. Don't you worry about him. You gotta go to the hospital too, you know.
Hell no, she said, and struggled to get off the ground, using the bumper of a car to pull herself up, and walked toward her truck. I'm not going, and you're not making me, she insisted. If she did go to the hospital, she would have to suffer the indignities of a rape kit, the paper gown, the countless explanations that no, it really didn't hurt. Nothing did. The puzzled and helpless looks as they discharged her without fixing a goddamn thing.
Can you be reasonable, please? You're hurt, he said, imploring her to agree to get checked out.
I'm not hurt, she said, leaning against the car. It's nothing. His demeanor shifted in recognition.
Kit, sometimes when you've been through something really awful, your body kind of shuts down. You know, you don't feel pain so you can get out of trouble quick. It's a useful thing, he said. But the pain always comes sooner or later.
She felt embarrassed at this, like he was saying something true, something for which she had no response. She didn't like to think about the pain, waiting in the wings for its moment to return. It was nice to see him worried for her, but she had been to enough hospitals over the years to know going to one now would only make things worse. You think they're gonna put me in a nice room, tuck me into bed, and ask me how I feel? Shit, they're just gonna throw me in the hallway with all the other people who look like me, make me wait 7 hours just to slap on a Band-Aid, and send me on my way. He pinched his brow at her, like he couldn't believe her but didn't want to argue. Then he sighed loudly and said,
I'm going to at least stay with you for a bit.
Kit relaxed a little at this. Can you patch me up before Charlie gets back? She could still taste iron from where Trip had bitten her lip, and her knuckles were split from the punching.
I can take care of you, he said.
And Kit was surprised when he didn't blush but held her in his gaze. She nodded and hobbled slowly toward the passenger seat with Caleb close enough to touch. An ashy light began to show as Caleb pulled up the gravel drive to his house. A giant orange tabby left his bed in the azaleas to greet them, wove between his owner's legs. Caleb shooed him off and walked around to Kit. He offered an arm to help her out of the car, but she refused, hoisted herself forward, and stiff-legged, made her way to his door. He went in ahead of her and clattered around in a cabinet for his first aid supplies, laid them out on a tray lined with a clean towel. She lingered at the doorway, waiting for direction. Your house is neat as shit, she said, and could hear from the fatty sound of her voice that she was still drunk. Where am I supposed to sit? I'm filthy. He held his hand out to her.
Sit here, he said,
and led her to the taut and tidy couch. She collapsed onto it, and he lifted her feet and propped up her head with a pillow. Caleb gloved his hands and loaded a cotton ball with alcohol. She blinked her eyes against the fumes. As he dabbed the oozy cuts on her lips, he seemed to maintain a clinical distance, his face calm, removed, his touch careful and efficient. But Kit could tell by the blush across his neck that he was embarrassed, or enlivened by their closeness. When he was finished, he handed her a glass of water. She drank it all at once, coughing at the last gulp.
I have to test you for a concussion now.
He shone a penlight in her eyes.
What's your name?
Tom Selleck. A hedging laugh.
Do you feel nauseated?
No.
That's good, he said. Can you hold out your arms and touch your fingers to your nose?
She reached out straight and as she touched her nose, she snarfed, a spasm of a laugh.
"I don't think I've ever heard you laugh before," he said.
He looked guarded, but amused.
"Sorry," she said, and covered a smile. "Now I know there's something wrong with you," he jabbed.
She smiled again, this time letting it show. He exhaled deeply.
"Well, should I take you home?"
The thin morning sun shone through the curtains, lighting up his face. Kit nodded. Caleb headed to the door, but Kit stopped him. "Hey." She reached toward him for a lift off the sofa. He took her hand, those pretty nails of his, and helped her to stand.
"You saved a life today," she said, and clapped him on the back. "I was gonna kill that motherfucker."
He smoothed back his hair, the creases gone from his brow, and for a moment they shared a smile, uncomplicated, between two people who might be friends.